Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for May 30th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, kin selection and the evolution of eusociality. Insights into supernova through an echo of light. Budget cuts mean an uncertain future for Fermilab and particle physics in the United States. And we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Located about 11,000 light years away, Cassiopeia A is one of the most studied objects in the sky. It's a remnant of a supernova explosion, and the light from that explosion swept past Earth more than 300 years ago. But in this week's Science, Oliver Krauss and colleagues report in a paper that they have nonetheless found a way to analyze that light. Using the Spitzer Space Telescope, they traced and analyzed what they describe as the supernova's echo, or light that is absorbed and re-emitted by interstellar particles. That's allowed them to conclude that the supernova was a Type 2b explosion, meaning that the collapsing star was a red supergiant. I spoke with Krauss from his office at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Germany.
In our paper, we could determine for the first time the type of an ancient galactic supernova long after the explosion by measuring or by analyzing light echoes of the original supernova outburst, and which is possible still hundreds of years after the initial light flash from the supernova has swept past Earth. And in doing so, we have determined that the Cassiopeia A supernova remnant originated from the core collapse of a red supergiant in a Type 2b explosion. It is important because Cassiopeia A is one of the most studied objects on sky over a very broad wavelength range, and it is a prototypical object for many fields of astrophysics, from the acceleration of cosmic rays up to the creation of dust particles. And for us, it is very important to have final clues on the progenitor and how the Cassiopeia A remnant was created.
And so your team analyzed the absorption and re-emission, or what you're calling an echo of light?
Yes, I mean, so what our team did was the following. So far, it was only the remnant which was studied. And using the Spitzer Space Telescope, an infrared space telescope, 3 years ago, we have discovered infrared echoes nearby this supernova remnant. So nearby infrared echoes means these are infrared emission features which flare up and disappear, and they originate from illumination of interstellar dust particles or grains by incoming radiation from the supernova flash are heated up, and they re-emit infrared emission during cooling down. And looking at these infrared echoes, we could finally analyze the illuminating component, which is the light emission of the supernova itself, so the much fainter optical emission, the direct light of the supernova again, in a kind of time machine. Because of the finite speed of light, we can see the emission still bouncing off the clouds 100 years later.
So the light burst that passed Earth was some 300 years ago or so.
Yeah, from kinematics of the remnant, from the velocity of the ejector, it is estimated that the explosion happened around 1680.
So you're essentially looking at a position in the sky that's further than the Earth is from this supernova. Is that right, to look for this echo of light?
In principle, yes. The total length of light way, let's say, is 328 years longer than the direct distance, yes.
Okay. So what were you and your team able to conclude about Cassiopeia A, given this analysis of this echo of light?
So we could unambiguously determine that the type of the supernova was 2B. And now, I mean, to have now the proof what it finally was is very important, because it's such a well-studied object, and it's our prototype of a massive core collapse supernova. And since supernovae have many, many implications for astrophysics, but at the end, even for life, it's also for the energetics of a galaxy, for the energetics in the interstellar medium. And knowing now the progenitor and the type of explosion, quite a rare type, who led to the most studied supernova remnant in our galaxy, is kind of an important scientific result.
Is this a technique that others will be able to apply to other past supernova?
It has been recently applied for an extragalactic supernova, this method, which was certainly also very important. However, in this specific case for Cassiopeia A, I mean, the advantage is that we have really an object in our backyard and have all the measurements already in hand on the supernova remnant, and now we can really link together everything we know about the remnant with the details of the explosion. It's really like a Rosetta Stone to link these two phases of the supernova, the most important phase of the supernova, together.
Because the extragalactic or other supernova are so much further away, you don't get the remnant data that you do of this one?
Yes, they are much further away, and in the other specific cases, there's certainly not at all so much information available on this specific supernova.
Well, Oliver Krauss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oliver Krauss is lead author of a paper on the Cassiopeia A supernova. Read the paper in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
It's long been an evolutionary puzzle how eusocial behavior evolved. Observed in many insect species, eusociality is where individuals cooperate to raise their brothers and sisters. In some eusocial species, such as honeybees, most females are even incapable of reproducing. In this week's Science, Bill Hughes and colleagues report in a paper that eusociality of all 267 species they examined evolved from monogamy. I spoke with Hughes from his office at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom.
It's been thought for about the last 40 years that helping relatives is really the key reason why social insects have evolved the kind of altruistic social behavior that we see. But E.O. Wilson recently suggested that, in fact, relatedness might not be important. And what we really do in this paper is provide the first evidence to test this. And we use a statistical method called ancestral state reconstruction to infer what were the ancestral mating frequencies for social insects. And we find that they were always monogamous, which shows that relatedness was key to the evolution of eusociality.
So what's the accepted model then for the evolution of this eusocial behavior? Kin selection theory?
That's right. Kin selection is the accepted model pretty much since the work of Bill Hamilton in 64. The basic idea is that although you can pass on copies of your gene by reproducing yourself, you could also pass on copies of your genes by helping your relatives with whom you obviously share your genes. And so that's why social insects are thought to be social, because they can be sterile and help their relatives and therefore have more reproductive success than if they reproduce themselves. That was the kind of accepted model until very recently.
Okay. So what specifically did your team test in looking at this?
What we specifically tested was we specifically looked at female mating frequencies, because if the ancestral social insect female mated with only a single male, then that would mean that her offspring are going to be highly related, which would suggest that relatedness has been important for eusociality to evolve. On the other hand, if it turned out that the ancestral social insect female mated with multiple males, as many animals do, and indeed quite a few extant species of social insects do that, then that would suggest that perhaps relatedness hasn't been so important and that Wilson perhaps is correct. But what we in fact found was that for all of the social insects that we're able to get data for, and for which we're able to infer these ancestral states, we found that monogamy was the ancestral state. So the ancestral social insect in 8 of the lineages that we had data for, they were always monogamous, suggests that relatedness has been crucial.
So all of these various social insects that you looked at now are not necessarily monogamous, but they were at some time in the past.
That's correct, yeah. The ancestor was. So in fact, around about a third of species of modern-day social insects show some level of polyandry, and some certain number of species, like, for example, the honeybee, show really quite extreme levels of polyandry, females mating with many different males. But that doesn't actually tell us very much. What we need to know is what the ancestor was doing, and that's what our analysis has shown.
And how exactly does that analysis work?
What we basically do is take the data that we have on mating frequencies for modern-day species, and we take the phylogenetic information we have for those species, which is pretty good for the social insects, and then we can use a statistical technique called ancestral state reconstruction to infer what were the most probable ancestral states.
Is it likely that there might be some sort of confounding factor in there?
No, the data is pretty solid, I would say.
And how many different species did you look at?
We had 267 species in the analysis. The representation between the different groups of social insects does vary. And the kind of robustness of analysis is stronger in some and slightly weaker in others, but they're all giving the same answer, that monogamy was the ancestral state. So it looks pretty reliable.
So there was monogamy, eusocial behavior, and then polyandry evolved.
That's right, yeah. So that's the point, is that a lot of the modern-day species are irreversibly eusocial. They can't go back. They've got these sterile workers living within a colony. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to subsequently re-evolve a solitary lifestyle, because a honeybee worker is so highly adapted towards its sterile existence as part of the colony. And so once you've got that, once you've got eusociality to the point that it's very hard for it to revert back, then it seems that polyandry can evolve. And we actually did a second analysis in which we looked at the frequency of polyandry compared with monogamy in species of social insects in which workers still can reproduce themselves. And we found that in almost all of those species, females tended to be monogamous, whereas those species which show polyandry are always the ones where the workers have lost the ability to reproduce themselves.
Sort of stuck then in a eusocial behavior.
That's right, yeah.
Are there any broader implications?
Well, I think understanding why social insects should be social, why they should have this altruism at face value, seems like a pretty big problem for the whole theory of natural selection. So it's really important that we do understand why they do it. And, you know, we thought we did. Wilson put forward an alternative, and now we've provided some evidence to distinguish between those two alternatives. So both of the hypotheses were still in keeping with natural selection, but it tells us how it's going about. I mean, it provides actually some evidence for how these things evolved, whereas previously what we had was two hypotheses, one very well established and reasonable, another more recent, but there wasn't really any evidence to distinguish between the two of them, and that's really what our study's done, is give us some evidence there. And I think that's the main point of the research.
Well, Bill Hughes, thank you very much.
Good to speak to you.
Bill Hughes is lead author of a paper on the evolution of eusociality. You can read the paper in this week's Science. These are uncertain times for Fermilab and the future of particle physics in the United States. Last-minute congressional budget cuts are to blame for the immediate problems of the lab. But as science news writer Adrian Cho reports, so too are a number of other factors that will leave the lab without enough to do when the Tevatron, or Circular Particle Accelerator, is shut down, which is scheduled to happen in 2010.
Essentially, the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, or Fermilab, in Batavia, Illinois, is in something of a crisis right now. It's the last dedicated particle physics lab in the United States, and it still has the world's highest energy particle smasher running, the Tevatron Collider. But the lab has essentially nothing in the pipeline for the coming decade, and recent budget cuts are forcing it to lay off about 7% of its workforce. So the future of the lab looks extremely uncertain. The center of gravity for particle physics is moving to Europe. Researchers at the European laboratory CERN near Geneva, Switzerland, are going to turn on the Large Hadron Collider this year, and that will smash particles at energy 7 times as high as the Tevatron can, and surpass the Tevatron. So Fermilab is looking for a new mission, and right now they don't have one, and so the lab is in something of a crisis.
When did these budget cuts happen?
So the budget cuts are the immediate cause of the problems at the lab, and these came about because of the political wrangling between President George W. Bush and Congress last year. Congress passed a budget that was $22 billion higher than the president had requested, and the president stamped his foot and said, no, you must bring this total down. Well, there was a frenzy of last-minute budget cutting, and one of the things that got cut was the budget for Fermilab, which got trimmed from a requested $372 million to $320 million. That was $22 million less than Fermilab had received the year before. And there were some also very specific cuts to Fermilab. Fermilab was hoping, and still is, hoping to build a neutrino experiment called NOVA that would study these very elusive subatomic particles. And they were expecting to get $36 million to work on NOVA and to get into construction this year, and Congress zeroed that out. Fermilab researchers have also been working on research and development for the next great particle smasher, the machine that would come after the LHC at CERN, which is called the International Linear Collider. And this is a 40-kilometer-long behemoth that involves two straight accelerators that fire beams of electrons and positrons right at each other. So Congress cut $14 million for work on the International Linear Collider at Fermilab. and they cut another $18 million for research and development on advanced accelerator technology called superconducting RF. So putting all those cuts together put the lab in a very precarious situation, and moreover, the cuts specifically targeted the things that Fermilab had in the works for future programs. So that left Fermilab in the situation where their present is quite good. The Tevatron is running better than people had expected. They have a chance to snare the Higgs boson, the famous Higgs boson, which is essentially the missing link in the theory of the current particles and the one particle that's thought to give all the others their mass. And they have a shot at getting that before the Large Hadron Collider surpasses them. But looking down the road into the next decade, the future looks pretty tenuous for Fermilab.
So are these short-term funding problems in the midst of a war, or do these budget cuts signify something else for Fermilab?
Well, so the immediate cause of the problems are the budget cuts, but the roots of the problem go back farther. So since about 2000 or 2001, physicists in the United States have been pushing quite hard to get going on the International Linear Collider. A few years ago, the thought was that they wanted to get the International Linear Collider up and running, you know, just a few years after the Large Hadron Collider came online. So people have been pushing very hard for this. And I think it's fair to say that most physicists agree that it's a worthy project. But many physicists at Fermilab and some at other places as well argue that the Department of Energy, which runs Fermilab and a large fraction of the physics community, pushed too hard and too fast for the Linear Collider. And as a result, they essentially abandoned all the smaller projects that Fermilab had proposed, and that left Fermilab essentially with nothing under construction or nothing in the works to replace what they're doing right now when the budget axe fell. They had nothing but plans and proposals, and those made easy targets for congressional staffers looking for things to cut at the last minute.
So are researchers at Fermilab pinning their hopes for the U.S. particle physics program to the next administration, or are there other new projects in the works?
So what they've proposed is an idea that's actually been kicking around since about 1994, which is to build essentially a much smaller linear accelerator like the one that would be used in the International Linear Collider, but to use it to accelerate protons. And the idea would be to do a suite of smaller experiments. Mind you, these are still pretty big experiments, but smaller experiments in which you would study the familiar particles in great detail, looking for things that don't quite fit with the current theory, the standard model, which would be hints of new physics and perhaps new phenomenon. So this is a sort of alternative to trying to simply go to the highest energies. This is a tack where you try to look at the finest details. And this project, which has this funny name, Project X, would cost about $1 billion. The exact price isn't known, and would give the lab essentially work to do through the next decade. The guts of the machine would also be designed to be fairly similar to the ILC. So that's the proposal now.
So they're looking for something to fill the gap in between the International Linear Collider and the shutdown of the Tevatron. So what happens if they don't get Project X to tide them over?
Then the situation becomes extremely uncertain, and this, I think, is what most physicists are worried about. If there is nothing in the works to give the lab another facility once the Tevatron shuts down, then Pierre Adone, the director of the lab, has said that the lab will likely have to cut another 10 to 15% of personnel, so it will get smaller. Now, Fermilab has other things going, to be sure, but one of the problems is that none of these other things is absolutely anchored to the lab, and if the lab starts to get smaller, then foreseeably these other things could be shifted to other labs, perhaps saving the Department of Energy the expense of running this 2,700-hectare campus.
I would suggest that the state of Illinois might be interested in keeping it around.
You would think. So the concern that you hear is that people are afraid that it will sooner or later close down. That's the big fear. I guess I would just say that Fermilab and particle physics in the United States faces a riches to rags predicament, right? The present is quite good. The future looks really questionable.
Adrian Cho, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Science news writer Adrian Cho reports on the future of Fermilab. You can read his article in this week's Science. Here with a policy update on science funding, Science's deputy editor Barbara Jasny says there may be a glimmer of hope for future funding for Fermilab and other U.S. science agencies through a supplemental appropriations bill.
The two branches of Congress recently passed separate versions of a more than $180 billion supplemental appropriations bill in hopes of reaching a compromise in June. The Senate's version would give the National Institutes of Health $400 million, which could mean 700 additional research grants. In addition, the Department of Energy's Office of Science would receive $55 million for fusion energy sciences and $45 million for high energy physics. This would enable the United States to rejoin the International Fusion Project, ITER, and help with some of the immediate funding problems at Fermilab. The Senate also allocated $150 million for basic research activities at the National Science Foundation and an additional $50 million for math and science education programs. NASA was given $200 million to replenish accounts drained for the space shuttle's return to flight. And finally, the Food and Drug Administration received $275 million, mainly for improving food and drug safety. But the House version of the bill does not include funds for any of these programs. In addition, the president has threatened to veto the supplemental funding bill if it contains any extraneous funds for domestic programs. So, the outcome is far from certain.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. For more budget analysis, go to www.aaas.org and click on R&D Budget Analysis on the left-hand side of the page. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about what goes on in our brains when we decide to trust somebody. We're going to solve the case of the telltale fingertips. And finally, we're going to talk about a frog that resembles a comic book superhero.
Let's start with what goes on in our brain when we decide to trust somebody. Is this neurochemistry?
Yeah, it is, Rob. This story has to deal with a hormone called oxytocin, which in the past has been linked to trust. For example, researchers have done studies with people who pretended to be investors, say, in the lab, and when they sniff oxytocin, they're more likely to part with their money than people who didn't sniff oxytocin. So the researchers know that this hormone is related to our ability to trust other people, but they don't know exactly how it works in the brain.
So what did these researchers do?
So what these researchers did was they conducted an experiment kind of like the investor experiment that I just mentioned. They recruited 49 men and had them play a game where they could give other people money, and these other people would either ostensibly invest this money, make a profit, and share that profit with the original person, or they could gyp the original person and keep the money for themselves. So when this person gave out his money, he wasn't sure whether he was going to get any money back or whether the other person was just going to make off with his money. And what the researchers found is that when the volunteers got a whiff of oxytocin before they played the game, they were more likely to part with their money as they expected. But what they did differently in this experiment was they actually monitored their brains during these transactions to see how oxytocin was working. And what they found was oxytocin created a drop in activity in two brain regions. One region was called the amygdala, which plays a key role in triggering fear. And the other was a region called the dorsal striatum, which is a region involved in learning from mistakes.
And they used, what, functional magnetic resonance imaging?
Right. And this is basically a technique that monitors blood flow to various parts of the brain. So when there's decrease in blood flow in one part of the brain, say in the amygdala or the dorsal striatum, the researchers knew that there was less activity. And the interesting thing about both of these regions is because they're involved with fear and learning from mistakes, the idea is that when you diminish these regions, you're less scared potentially about parting with your money, and you're less likely to learn if somebody makes off with your money. You may do the same thing again. And that's what researchers saw in this experiment. Even when the volunteers gave their money away and the person they gave it to made off with their money, if they sniffed oxytocin, they were more likely to give their money back to the same person again. So again, they were trusting these people, even perhaps against their better judgment, but the oxytocin was making them trust these people, and so they were continually giving them money even when maybe they shouldn't have.
I can think of lots of bad ways this might be used. What's a good way to apply this knowledge? Perhaps people who have too much fear and distrust?
Well, exactly. I mean, what this study is really telling us is beyond just trust, oxytocin is really decreasing our fear of betrayal by others, which is really important for societies because individuals overall really need to trust each other to stay in large groups. And what that might mean is that individuals who have disorders such as autism or schizophrenia, where there's a distrust of other people, may have problems with oxytocin or one of the pathways it's involved in. So this research could potentially shed light on a number of psychological disorders.
Well, from the mystery of how neurochemistry affects our trust to the mystery of the telltale fingertips, what are we talking about here?
Well, Rob, the mystery here involves a disorder called clubbing, which is a swelling of the fingertips. And if you want to see a picture of what this looks like, you can check out the site. But basically, individuals that have this, it's an important clue to others' disorders. If they have swollen fingertips, they're more likely to have serious disorders such as lung disease and heart disease. And it's actually something doctors look for when they're trying to predict other conditions. But researchers really don't know what the root cause of these swollen fingers is.
So they're looking for some genetic clue?
Right. Well, what they did was they recruited a bunch of people that had a particular type of clubbing disorder. And this disorder is known as primary hypertrophic osteoarthropathy. And this represents about 3 to 5% of all cases of clubbing. And they scanned all these individuals and they found that they all had a mutation in a gene called HPGD. And what's important about this gene is it encodes an enzyme that breaks down prostaglandins. And prostaglandins are hormone-like molecules that promote inflammation and help regulate fluid balance in the blood. So it seems obvious that they might play a role in clubbing. And indeed, the researchers found that in these individuals, there were elevated levels of a prostaglandin called PGE2. And that sort of confirmed their hypothesis that prostaglandins may be involved in swelling of the fingertips seen in these individuals.
And presumably, this could be applied for people who don't have this genetic disorder. So has this led to some new test or something?
Well, the researchers think that now that they have an idea of what's going wrong, they can develop, say, a urine test that might help doctors better diagnose this particular type of clubbing, but also suggest that perhaps by interfering with this prostaglandin production, they might be able to cure people that have this condition and other types of clubbing.
And how will that apply to people who get clubbing who don't have the genetic predisposition for clubbing?
Well, because clubbing is associated with lung cancer and heart disease and other illnesses, researchers may also be able to use these tests to help diagnose these other conditions.
And what are other researchers saying about this study?
Well, researchers are saying this is a really promising result, but one researcher says that it's possible that it's not the prostaglandins themselves that are causing the clubbing, because sometimes prostaglandins are actually given to people to treat other disorders, and these people don't develop clubbing. So it's possible that there's some other pathway that's related to prostaglandins that's involved, but that just hasn't been worked out yet.
Well, from the obvious signs of clubbed fingers to the unobvious characteristics of a frog superhero. I imagine this frog transforms in some way, like most superheroes do, or would have been noticed before?
Right, Rob. Well, the superhero we're talking about here is Wolverine of X-Men fame. And if you don't know Wolverine, he's a character who has metal claws that shoot out of his knuckles, basically, or shoot out between his knuckles when he's about to get into a fight. And researchers have discovered a frog that does very much the same thing. This frog has bone-like claws that shoot out from its fingertips, ostensibly when it's about to get into a fight. But it took a lot of work for researchers to discover this.
I would think just handling the frogs would cause these bony structures to come out and somebody might get scratched.
Well, that was the first clue that these frogs had these hidden weapons. When the researcher that led this study looked at frogs in Cameroon, every time he would pick up these frogs, they would scratch the heck out of them. And so he knew that they had some sort of secret weapon. And so what he and his team did was they intensively studied museum specimens of these frogs, which belonged to a family called Arthroleptidae. And the reason they had to study museum specimens is because Cameroon has strict laws about researchers taking wild animals back to their labs. And what they found was that these frogs had these talon-shaped finger bones, which they were observing a little too up close and personal in the wild. But they were connected to a small bony nodule in the frog's fingertips. And what it looked like what was happening was that when these fingertips were sheathed, but when the frogs got attacked, their claws would break the connection with these sheaths and shoot out of the fingertips.
So it's actually breaking the skin as it comes out.
These claws actually appear to be breaking the skin as they come out, which sounds painful and also seems dangerous. But amphibians are known to have a remarkable ability to self-heal, much, again, like Wolverine. So the researchers suspect that even if this is the way it happens, when the claws are retracted again, the frogs may be able to quickly heal themselves.
Now, is this just a defensive mechanism, or have they observed the frogs actually using these for attacking purposes?
Well, the researchers suspect this is a mechanism for defense, but one expert says these might not be weapons at all. Perhaps the frogs just use them to get a better grip on whatever habitat they happen to be climbing over. So these wolverines of the wild may not be using these claws like warriors. They may just be using them to get around.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about why gobies cheat, how insects socialize, and what's going on with briny springs on Mars. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to the January 25th Education Forum, Application of Bloom's Taxonomy Debunks the MCAT Myth. In that article, Zeng and colleagues suggest that college introductory biology courses that emphasize factual recall do not prepare students for the higher level thinking they'll need to get into medical school.
In the May 9th issue, Shi Sun Go from Hangzhou Normal University writes in to defend focusing on facts in introductory courses. Guo writes, "At different stages of the whole educational process, instructional purposes are different. Time-consuming lower-level fact instruction at earlier stages will contribute to and guarantee higher-level thinking."
In response, Alex Zhang and two of his co-authors argue that neither the literature nor their data support Guo's claim. They write, "Guo's letter reflects a view held by a substantial proportion of instructors that introductory science courses should focus primarily or even exclusively on factual content. The data in our education forum indicated that biology students who intend to pursue medical or graduate school are poorly served by such courses."
You can read the full exchange in the May 9th issue. Next, two responses to a February 22nd news focus by Jennifer Cousin, titled Crossing the Divide. In that story, Cousin writes of the journey of paleontologist Stephen Godfrey in rejecting creationism and embracing evolution.
In the May 23rd issue, Craig Stevens from Oklahoma State University writes in to say that he found the article particularly disturbing and unworthy of publication in Science. He writes, "Give me a break. Had Science Magazine been around during the 17th century, would we have seen such consolatory text for those traumatized by the fact that the sun does not revolve around the earth?"
Stevens writes, "While Dr. Godfrey's escape from the ignorant shroud of biblical literalists is praiseworthy, Science Magazine is not the place to give even a hint of respectability to those who would deny the fundamental fact of evolution. There is too much at stake for our children and for our society to give any credence to those promoting unscientific nonsense, creationism, or intelligent design, and justifying irrational beliefs under the guise of religion."
From Taylor University, Andrew Whipple also writes in response, "The news focus story by Cousin, Crossing the Divide, accurately and respectfully describes the crux of the challenge that our scientific understanding presents to members of faith communities. With more than 20 years of experience in teaching biology to evangelical undergraduates, I can state with a high degree of confidence that the situation within evangelicalism is to a great extent just as Cousin presented."
Whipple writes, "In this short essay, Science has published the only example I have read in the leading scientific literature that takes the time and effort to understand and express what really drives the concerns of the majority of evangelicals, and does so in a manner that respects the integrity of both the scientific endeavor and the integrity of the faith commitments within the evangelical community."
In sum, Whipple suggests, "Let us all humbly seek for truth as we respect one another's efforts to do so." You can read the full exchange in the May 23rd issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. And that wraps up the May 30th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.